Hi, everyone. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Janet Foster Show, the show where you get real talk you can act on. You can get social with me on Facebook right now, live. I'm looking right at the page there. You can just search for Janet Foster on Facebook and definitely like the page and the post. That's the very first post. If you go ahead and post any of your thoughts there, I definitely will see it while we're here because it definitely this studio is like Grand Central Station right now. Also, you can send messages to me on Instagram and Twitter at Janet D. Foster. And just some quick shout outs to Gary Pritt, giving us a shout out on today's topic there. Thank you for listening, Gary. And Mila Gonzalez, thank you so much for your kind words. And definitely keep the tweets coming and keep the Instagram comments coming. We're building something really big here, and I am so happy to be connected to you. And certainly for today's topic, we've gotten a lot of excited interest from you, and I appreciate the commentary. And we are definitely going to get to it. Our topic for today's discussion is part two of our series, Reflections on Race. Basically, we are exploring the truth, whether or not we are living in a post-racial America. And certainly, I've previously mentioned that in our country, we have two generations of Americans, Gen Xers and millennials. We were basically born into an integrated society. Integrated meaning it was no longer legal to segregate people by race or to relegate facilities or schools, things of that nature. We were basically integrated from the time we entered public school system in terms of having individuals who look different from us. And that's something that we want to continue to explore because I think our two generations, I think we hold the key. We're definitely the generations that Dr. King was talking about. A lot of us weren't born then. Certainly, when we talk about the times where racial barriers were legal, our generation basically know that through history, what we were taught about the civil rights movement. And basically, we are the benefactors, in a sense. And I know based on headlines today, things could be a little different. You could argue that. But I think overall, for what we are experiencing in terms of opportunities, definitely we are benefactors of the dialogue that went on in the 60s, for sure. And certainly we do have elders in our lives, whether it's our parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles or cousins who were alive during those times in the 60s where they may have told us stories about it. That's the thing for us, that we got it through storytelling. And also, you know, there are many in our generations, both Gen X and millennial generations, there's a belief that racism will basically die out when those individuals who practiced it die. And we see now that there's an actual converse to that type of, and I put in quotes, tradition of racism and bias that's being passed on. We see it in our headlines. I mean, just recently, last week, a case of police brutality in New York City with famed tennis player James Blake. Also, you know, last year, the vendor in New York City who was really selling something, he died, he lost his life over a license, you know, just a vending license. And then, of course, the tragedy that rocked the nation earlier this summer, you know, the tragedy at Mother Emanuel Church really has kind of given a proof that nothing is going to be dying out anytime soon. If anything, a tradition is being passed on where people are choosing that, and very well it could be a choice. But one of the things that I'm really excited about is my guest today, Dr. Robin DiAngelo. She earned her PhD at the University of Washington in Seattle back in 2004. And she has such an outstanding background in her research and definitely in the discourse of, I think, multicultural studies. And one of the areas that she is a noted expert on is delving into the explanations of whiteness in studies and discourse along the explanations. And her work in that area has made her a sought-after facilitator for diversity training for city governments and corporations. And she's also an author of several articles that she's made contributions to discussion journals on in the fields of education, social justice. I mean, she has a very, very impressive and very long resume in terms of her work. She is currently a professor at Westfield State University, and she teaches courses in multicultural teaching, as well as intergroup dialogue facilitation, cultural diversity and social justice, and anti-racist education. And I just want to welcome her here. Dr. DiAngelo, are you on the line?
I am. Hello, Janet. Thank you so much.
Oh, you are so welcome. I woke up so excited. I'm always excited for all my shows, but today I just thought, oh, this is going to be so good. And a lot of my listeners have really been excited since we started promoting today's show on Wednesday. A lot of people have really become interested in your work. And I have to say how I even come to learn about your work. I actually got your books, both of your books, given to me as a gift because I have friends who know that I'm the nerd who really loves good discussions. And your two books, that one that you were co-author of is Everyone Really Equal, An Introduction to Key Concepts in Social Justice Education. And of course, the book that I want to talk to you about today, What Does It Mean to Be White? Developing White Racial Literacy. I devoured those books. It was I knocked them out in about 24 hours. And I just really, I'm very impressed with your work. And what I want to do is kind of, if you could give us a little background on yourself, because you use your own life experiences in a lot of the works that you do. And also give us a background for our audience, because even in terms of your degree that you studied, and the reason why I think it's so important for our audience to really grasp is a lot of times when you hear diversity training, you mm-hmm. always see people of color. And I have this theory that when we get a white straight male who is head of diversity at a company, that's when it gets fixed.
Yeah. Well, let me start by saying I'm a former professor at Westfield State. I did resign that position because I wanted to move back to the West Coast.
Okay.
So now I'm director of equity for a large nonprofit organization in senior services and also doing consulting. So whiteness studies is actually the field that my doctorate is in, and that sounds very odd to a lot of people, right? Like, whiteness studies, what's that? Well, for a very long time, probably centuries, if not decades, people of color have been pushing white people to basically stop looking at us and look at yourself, right? Mm-hmm. When white people who control the institutions and the education and the discourse, you know, studied race, they always studied people of color. You know, what is wrong with that group? You know, why do they have their problems? And people of color pushed back and said, our problem is you, so why don't you take a look at yourself and, you know, how do you see us? And how does that lead to some of the issues that we have? And you know, you can't have one without the other, right? So for me to have any sense of you as a person of color, I also have to have a sense of myself as white. Mm-hmm. Because what is a person of color not white, and what is white not a person of color? And so finally in the late 80s, early 90s, white academics took up that call and started focusing on white culture and white identity, and the ways that the water, if you will, reproduces racism. Mm-hmm. And so that's the field I got in, but I'm a little bit different than most academics in that I came from practice to theory. So, you know, I didn't go to college right out of high school and start studying, you know, race relations. I actually didn't go to college till later in life. I grew up poor and working class. And was not, you know, not encouraged to go to college, and I didn't have role models. But eventually I did get a degree in sociology and didn't know what I could do for a living. So the Career Center at my university was working with me, and one day they said, there's a position open that just seems like such a good fit for you. It's for a diversity trainer. And this was the early 90s when I had never heard of that. But when I read the job description, you're going to be going into the workplace and leading workshops on, you know, race and racial justice. It sounded like the coolest job I could think of. And I absolutely felt qualified because, you know, I am a vegetarian, you know, and I shop at Whole Foods. And I always bring my own bag. So, of course, I'm qualified to help other people have the open mind that I have. And, you know, I'm making fun of myself a little here, but that's because I really did think those were my qualifications. And I think most well-meaning white liberals, like myself, do just think it's all about being open-minded. Uh-huh. Because, another point I like to make, because everybody in the position to determine my qualifications was another super nice white liberal like me, I got the job. And, of course, I was completely unqualified and had no idea what I was in for. And that was actually, the job was to train the welfare department mm-hmm. workers. They had been sued. So, and they had lost, and it was mandated that every employee that worked for the welfare department had to have 16 hours of diversity training. And that's what I thought would be fun and that I could easily do. Mm-hmm. So they hired a really big interracial group of people, and we started with a 5-day train the trainer. And I was like a fish being taken out of water because immediately my racial worldview was being challenged by people of color. And part of being white is that I could live that long, go through college, have a degree, and never significantly have my racial worldview challenged. In fact, I wouldn't have been able to tell you I had a racial worldview, right? I was mm-hmm. just a person. And much less be challenged by a significant number of people of color in a sustained way. Because the way society is set up, it's just really easy to avoid that if you're white. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, basically my mind was getting blown. And then we went out into the workplace, and there was the whole next level of learning because the hostility, the incredible meanness of a primarily group of employed people who were outraged that they had to be talking about race and that, you know, that now that, you know, we're the ones being discriminated against. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at this room full of employed white people who are complaining that they can't get jobs anymore. And it's very unnerving, as I imagine you would know.
Yep, right. You
probably faced it more often than I ever have. But I just started really asking myself, how do we pull that off? How do we live so separate and claim to be so open and yet have such insistence that race has no meaning and at the same time be so emotional about it? Like, how do we pull that off?
Yes.
And because it was so patterned, you know, day in and day out, trying to talk to white people about racism, it's almost like we've been handed a script. You know, just here it comes. Oh, this one. Oh, that. You know, here it is. You know, yeah. I'm sure you've heard it a million times. And so I just got better and clearer at figuring out how we get socialized to end up in those kinds of engagements. And I also got much better at articulating it. And, you know, it's one of the dilemmas of being a white person in this work. On the one hand, because of the way racism works, I can be heard in a way that you can't, right? I'm not seen as biased. I don't have a chip on my shoulder. I'm not playing the race card. And so I can say so much more and get away with it. Mm-hmm. And I can also speak to a shared identity, right? It's like, come on, you know, and I know, and, you know, we know. And white people, we can't deny it.
Right.
And so I'm definitely, you know, I'm committed to using that position. But at the same time, by being the authority on race in front of people who couldn't hear it from you, but they can hear it from me, I'm simultaneously reinforcing racism. Right? It's a dilemma. But in the end, it's kind of like, yeah, and to not do it is to basically really be white.
Yeah.
To be silent on racism is to be white. And so I want to break with that. And if, you know, I will use my position, to not use my position in service of racial justice is basically to support racism, because the default is racist. White people just live our lives the way we were set up to live them. That the system depends on us doing that.
Yeah, you know, you bring up a good point when you were talking about, you were kind of comparing your role in discussion of racism is could be considered racism. And how I view it is kind of how we deal with vaccinations. I know some people have issues with that, but it's almost like you've got to take whatever the quote unquote particles of the illness and inject it. And that's sort of what I see your role doing. And I just find it impressive that how you arrived at your aha moment just with that first job that you had.
Yeah.
And I like too how you describe, because some of the things you describe your book, What Does It Mean to Be White? You talk about something called racially illiterate, and it sounds like you were leading up to that. Can you break that down for our audience?
Oh, yeah. Well, I like to say, like, put it like this. I've never met a white person without an opinion on race. Have you?
You know what?
I'm being a little facetious.
But not to my face.
Well, no, they didn't mean opinion, right? Everybody has an opinion on race, right?
Yeah.
And racism, right? You know, ask anybody on the street and they're going to give you their opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So we all have our opinions, but if you are white and you gained your opinion on this topic the way we gain our opinions on many things, right? We live our lives, we have our experiences, we travel, we read, we go to college, perhaps we have relationships, we have friendships, you name it, you know, whatever it is that we get to a, you know, full adult. And we have a perspective on most topics. But if that is the way you gained your perspective as a white person, rather than sustained, ongoing practice and study, then your opinion on racism is necessarily misinformed. And I'm speaking now to white people, right?
Uh-huh.
And I do say this to them. And I'll go so far as to say, your opinion on race is necessarily ignorant. Because society simply does not provide you with the information you need to have an informed opinion on race and racism, right? So I have an opinion on every topic, right? I can look up at the sky and give you my opinion on it, but I'm not going to be able to discuss it with Neil deGrasse Tyson, right?
Right, right.
Because he has committed, you know, years and years and years of study and nuance and, you know, engagement. And again, I've got opinions from the sky. You know, I've gone camping. I've looked at the constellation. You know, I could name all these things, but they're very, very superficial. You can get a doctoral degree and never get a good information on race and racism in this country, and certainly not sustained. You can get a doctorate degree and never have a professor of color or a teacher of color in your life. So if you are not really, really working in a consistent way, you're just going to have a very superficial opinion. And so that's basically my way of capturing that is white people are illiterate. We cannot really engage in a conversation on this topic beyond the most superficial platitudes, right?
Right.
Everybody just should, or why don't they, or, you know, just these vapid, meaningless
terms.
phrases.
Mm-hmm.
And we, yeah, I, you know, I'm like, I could go on and on.
Yeah.
So,
definitely.
Yeah, I think one of the great challenges for white people is humility. And we don't have much humility on this topic. So I was just thinking about this when I was listening to your opening, because you said so many things that I was taking notes, right?
Right.
Oh, I want to speak to that. But you were talking about the millennials thinking that when the old folks die off, racism will die off.
Right.
And I think that is probably the most effective and brilliant adaptation of racism over time, is to basically reproduce the same racial disparity that's always been reproduced in our society,
mm-hmm.
and yet have each individual person feel like they have nothing to do with it, right?
Right.
So by every measure, racial disparity is a lot. I mean, I'm not even talking about the extreme cases of violence. I'm talking about our schools, the prison system, medical, you know, healthcare.
Right.
Every measure, there is racial disparity. And yet no individual person feels like they have anything to do with it.
Right.
You know, pre-civil rights, white people could just come out and say, of course we're better, right?
And right.
That was socially acceptable. Post-civil rights, that's not acceptable. And it seems on its surface like a positive thing to make racism bad, right? It's bad to be racist.
Right.
Oh, well, that seems like a positive thing. Well, it's such a clever system that what it did is make it virtually impossible to talk to white people about our inevitable socialization into the system.
Right.
We lose our minds, because what we hear is, you are a bad person.
Right. Yeah. And it feels like an attack.
Yeah. It's like an either or, right? To be a good person and to have any kind of connection to racism is mutually exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I call that the good-bad binary, right? A racist is a bad, terrible, bigoted person, usually
right.
old and southern, and a, you know, a not racist is open and liberal and progressive and educated, right, and
right.
northern, and nobody sees themselves on that other side. So we need to understand racism as a system, right? It's the water we swim in. It doesn't really depend on individual players. I mean, it manifests in that way, but it doesn't depend on it. Thinking back to the diversity training, the train the trainer I mentioned when I was like a fish being taken out of water.
Yes.
I often tell the story of the very first day of that training, and one of the arguments we were getting into is white people were asking questions of the people of color. Now remember, we'd all just been hired for this contract, and the
mm-hmm.
people of color were saying, it's not our job to teach you. And I remember being just taking such umbrage to that, like, oh, then how am I supposed to know, you know, if you're not going to tell me? So there's, you know, sub-narrative under there is whites are innocent. The whites don't know anything about race. You know, people of color have race. People of color hold racial knowledge, right? I mean, that's
mm-hmm.
the ideology that we're given,
right.
kind of white innocence. And so just like, well, of course I don't know anything about it. Why don't you tell me? And the irony is, I clearly then wasn't qualified for that job, then, was I? But that never occurred to any of the white people in the room, that we weren't qualified for the jobs we got.
Right.
They should just be teaching us. But the afternoon of the first day, this white woman calls out into the room. There's like 40 of us, and she calls out, all the white racists, raise your hand. And almost every white person raised their hand. And I remember looking and going, and just in shock, like, oh, my God. I'm not raising my hand. I'm not racist. And I went home just like feeling just so smug that I had demonstrated to everybody that I was the good one, you know, because I didn't raise my hand.
Right.
And I laughed because I look back now and I'm like, oh my God, of course I would raise my hand. But that's because I understand racism to be different than I understood it to be at the time, right?
Right.
I thought of racism the way I was taught to think about it, the way most white people are taught to think about it, which functions beautifully to hide it. We're taught to see it as conscious dislike, you know?
Right.
This is why so many white people, as evidence that they don't have racism, will cite all their family and friends. They're giving you evidence that, you see, I like people of color, therefore I can't be racist.
Right,
so
yeah.
When I heard that, you know, you know, raise your hand, I heard if you basically hate people of color. And the other thing that I look back and realize is, while I'm the least qualified to judge whether I understand this, because I went home feeling kind of cocky, like, okay, everybody sees I'm the good white one. And now I realize, like, cringing, like, no, everybody sees that I'm the clueless white one, right? I'm the one that didn't understand what racism was.
Right.
So because I understand today as a system that's inevitable, you know, we're socialized into it, it's just good, bad is just not relevant.
Right.
Like, the question is, it's always happening. So how is it happening so that I can interrupt it?
Exactly. And the point you made about basically white people have an option in life that potentially they can basically live a life where no person of color ever comes into their world. And
yeah,
that's why they can't see it.
Yeah. Oh, and I was gonna say, and then you add to that, no, this, that is a pretty thin veneer, because white people get pretty mean pretty quick when challenged racially. You might have
Hell.
Noticed that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it just depends. You know, I'm always the person of color, particularly the African American, because my family was the black family in that neighborhood,
yeah.
You know. So and I always tell people, you know, we're the exception, not the rule. So you don't have any street cred. So don't use me
right.
as your credit, you know.
Right. Yeah, and they were all your best friends, right?
Yeah, and I was a little bit more isolated because also in school, I was in the advanced academic program, which takes another swing to that. And the tendency with, you know, children who are in advanced academic environments, we tend to get along a lot better. And actually, to this day, we're all still friends because all of us went to college. And, you know, mine is a little bit different than a lot of other people, but you are correct. I have witnessed some people getting upset. And sometimes I always wonder if it's just fear that their heart may be, I really have no malice, but do I look like I have malice? And it's more of a defensive mechanism.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a generous take. I do think that is in there. And think about it. So we grow up in racial segregation. Most white people grow up in racial segregation that they choose, right?
Mm-hmm.
White people choose racial segregation. You know, we love those good schools and good neighborhoods, and we
mm-hmm.
know exactly what that means, right?
Right.
And so we're left to gain our understanding of people of color from the most problematic sources, right? From media and movies and music and
right.
TV and jokes and comments and omissions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we're pumped with the most racist information. And so we also have some pretty negative feelings about people of color. I don't think you have to scratch very hard on white people, and some pretty ugly feelings come out because we're just 24/7 getting the message of their inferiority and our superiority. That's just undeniable. It's not
yeah.
as if, hey, I didn't, you know, I don't know anything and I never got any messages. Let's start with the absence. Segregation is a profound message.
Mm-hmm.
The message of segregation is there's no inherent value in the presence, perspective, experiences, or relationships with people of color. That's the message. That is a deep message.
Yes.
Now add, you know, all the negative, you know, dog whistle kind of stuff. And I do think there's some deep dislike under the surface. You know, and of course, it's mixed in with that being at odds with our most cherished values. So it makes us really like pieces of work, right? It makes us very confusing, very irrational
mm-hmm.
when that gets challenged.
Got it. Yeah. And,
yeah.
You know, you and this is a good transition to one of the things that you talk about in the book, one of the chapters where you go in depth into what you call popular white narratives that deny mm. racism.
Yeah.
And in this age of, I think, of snarkiness being vogue, particularly in politics. You see that the negative reinforcement. Can you give us some thoughts at kind of how you put that perspective together in your book and kind of how you gathered it and arrived at maybe explanations of this kind of behavior?
Yeah. I think, you know, like I had said earlier, because really for a living on a daily basis, I am trying to lead primarily white groups on racism. Mm-hmm. And you hear a lot of the same things over and over and over, right? So that when something is patterned, it doesn't mean it's patterned because it's true. It means it's patterned because that's what we've all been conditioned to see.
Yeah.
Right? Or to think how we've been conditioned to think. So you've got these pattern narratives that gave me lots of time to think about, right? And lots of opportunities to try to kind of question and work with. And I rarely ever trained alone. I was always with a team of people, and often people of color. So I also got to hear people of color's responses and takes, you know, to all of this. And so those two really intensive exposures, if you will, to kind of white reactions and perspectives on race and racism and people of colors, just deepened my understanding of how those narratives function. And that's the guiding question for me. So here's one that I used to hear a lot, or I do hear a lot. Uh-huh. It's just human nature, right? Somebody has to be on top. People have always dominated. It's just human nature.
Really?
You ever heard that one? Oh, yeah. You never heard that one?
No,
love that.
Oh, that's new to me.
Oh, yeah. Well, if any of your callers have ever heard it. You know, whenever you get to a point where, you know, where you're pushing, then people will often default to, oh, well, you know, what can you do? It's just nature. You know, people have always dominated other people. And then often they'll launch into, you know, Africans had slaves and, you know, it's always been there.
Yeah.
So in thinking about that, you know, and as a sociologist, you know, I don't know that you can ever separate out nature from culture, right? Those are very perennial questions. Is it nature? Is it nurture? So since you can never really finally settle that, for me, I started asking, well, how does it function in a conversation about race and racism to default to it's just human nature? And then I realized, well, who's most likely to say that? Usually not the people being dominated. That is not the narrative of the oppressed, right? That it's
right.
Human nature to oppress. No, that is the narrative of the dominator. And so it was like, oh, okay. So that for me is the, you know, the clue, if you will, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had another thought and it just escaped me of another narrative. It'll come to me.
Okay.
So that's often what I will just ask is, how does it function? Oh, individualism. You know, that's a precious ideology, individualism or universalism. Individualism is we're all unique. And, you know, unique like snowflakes.
Uh-huh.
And then universalism is we're all the same. We all bleed under the skin. We're all God's children. And white people will invoke those in the same conversation, right? It's whatever works to get race off the table. That's what I think is happening, right?
Got it.
Because that is how it functions. So I'm not questioning that we're not each unique, and I'm not questioning that we're not all God's children bleed under the skin, you know, all of that. Of course, we are those things. And how does that function in a conversation about racism? Well, okay. When I ask that question, again, it takes race off the table. It obscures power and just kind of whitewashes the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that we can't really put our finger on anything. We can't change anything. There's nothing to change. So that's often what will, again, not is it true or is it false, but how does it function when we interject that into a discussion of race?
Got it. And during your workshops where you dealt with these narratives, did you find that there were any gender differences? Because, you know, from a person of color, a lot of times we tend to have more comfort with white women versus white males.
Yeah, although, boy, white women can be pretty treacherous too, don't you think?
Some can be creative depending on how they were raised.
Ever had a coworker or a white woman who you just want to okay, yes, because this is an exercise I often do in my workshops. It's actually really hard for people And I think it speaks to how deep and ongoing and lifelong these kinds of reflections need to be. Mm-hmm. But I will ask, pick a key identity other than race, and think about the ways you were socialized into that identity. So what are kind of the big social messages? And then once you've identified that, how does that conditioning set you up to collude with racism? So here's an example. For me, raised poor, female, Catholic, right? Mm-hmm. So those were, and the messages I got were be silent, be subservient, be invisible, be pretty, be pleasing, avoid conflict, right? Does that make sense to you that I would get those messages as a little Catholic girl?
Yes, because I'm Catholic.
Okay, okay, right? Yeah. Defer to, you know, sacrifice. Okay, so, and I do have those patterns. Now ask yourself, how does that set me up to collude with racism? Well, it sets me up beautifully because I'm going to avoid conflict. Mm-hmm. I'm going to want to be pleasing. I'm going to question whether I really know what I know. I'm not going to use my voice. And so the way I like to use individualism is, so that is my unique, you know, intersection of some key identities. And so in challenging those messages, because it's not true that I should be voiceless, and it's not true that I'm not smart, right? Mm-hmm. When I speak up about racism, not only am I using my privileged voice and position as a white person in service of justice, but I'm also challenging the lie that I'm not as smart, or that I shouldn't speak up, or that I should serve, and that I should sacrifice. I mean, those are messages I don't want to give my daughter. Mm-hmm. There are messages I wish I didn't have. And so I'm countering those messages when I stand for racial justice. And that's one of the reasons why I feel like this work is so empowering and exciting. It's not all about guilt and feeling bad. I'm clear that I am completely invested in racism, right? I was socialized to be invested in it, and that I have racist blind spots and patterns I don't even know I have. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel guilty about that. I mean, that's what I got set up for. Mm-hmm. I find this challenging that stuff to be the most intellectually, psychologically, spiritually, emotionally stimulating work I've ever encountered in my life. I wish white people could just see, oh, it's so exciting to identify your racist blind spots. You don't want to have them, do you?
Right.
So
yeah.
Identify and be thrilled that a person of color trusts you enough to take a chance to give you feedback. You know, yeah. Because usually it doesn't go very well, so they're taking a chance with you. That's fabulous, right?
Right. Yeah.
So that kind of leads to your question about white men. You know, they don't tend to get that message. They, you know, be in control, be intellectual, be rational, don't show your emotions, right? Uh-huh. So how does that set them up? Well, they're going to stay in their heads. They're going to dominate the conversation. They're going to determine whether you're correct or incorrect. You ever talk to a white guy who's like, when you can explain it to me in a way that makes sense to me, I'll validate that it's true.
Yeah, that means when someone says that, what I hear is basically, I'm not going to listen to anything that you're going to say. That's what I hear.
Well, yeah, right? Because I know best, you know, and those are classic white male patterns. I mean, you know, again, they didn't choose those patterns, but they're pretty predictable. It's pretty predictable in a workshop that the white men are either going to sit in silence, mm-hmm. and control that way, because it leaves all the women to feel anxious about what they're thinking and feeling. Right. Or they're going to dominate the whole conversation. Well, let me just play the devil's advocate here.
Yeah.
Just arrogant, pompous, self-righteous. Excuse me. I need to calm down here.
Speak on it.
You know what I mean? Those patterns. So those are very different than my patterns, but they're all patterns that set us up. So for in a way, for me, I've had to believe I was smart enough to speak out on this. Mm-hmm. I think for white men, they need to reach for humility and step back and be willing to not know. Just not know. It's okay. You may not ever understand it. It's real if Janet says it's real for her. So just listen.
Right.
Like, that is a huge interruption to male socialization, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is. So that's another reason why it's fantastic work, right?
Absolutely. I, like I said, I find your work, it's refreshing, and it makes, to me, it makes this discourse on race be much more substantive, you know, substantial in discussion, because it's just not all people of color saying, well, this is happening, this is happening.
Yeah.
And then you're that voice of, I think, reason one for people of color to first, you validate, yes, what you're seeing is really happening.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
you give to us. You give to us kind of those explanations, and just in our conversation today, things that you've kind of enlightened me on, you know, that I may have myself have been so conditioned at mm-hmm. certain responses. I've interviewed all kinds of people, and yeah. And you know, most of my interviewing has been in politics, and that lately, seeing how we've got, you know, a big big election next year, that just seems to reinforce a lot of the racial divide that's yeah. going on in this country, and some of it has to do with the gentleman that's residing at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, just for the mm-hmm. fact that he's there, that
yeah.
most people will not admit, and they kind of cloak behind either party rhetoric. Or, you know, they'll just say, well, it's not his race. But, and they kind of forget that the president is biracial.
Right.
They just completely forget that. And in your take on just on this issue is so so fascinating. And one thing that you talked about earlier that I want to get kind of circle back to
yeah.
is you kind of talked about some patterns of well-intentioned white people. And I know a lot of times that is associated with liberalism, but at the same time, it may be very religious people too, and not so much liberal in the sense of politics or anything like that. But, you know, there are some people religiously, they, you know, they think, well, I love my neighbor, but yet there's other behaviors that maybe they fall into, that they think they're being one way, but maybe another. Kind of what you, in your book, you kind of talk about the movie The Blind Side. I know it was tied to imagery, but just the whole, you know, the Tuohy family story, it kind of ties, they're tied to it as through religious beliefs in a sense. Can you share with us some thoughts on that?
Yeah. You know, I have a few thoughts that came up when you were speaking. I mean, obviously it's a really big, deep area that we could talk about. But the first thought that came to me when you were saying, you know, for religious people, love your neighbor, was, well, and who is your neighbor? I mean, you know, we're still segregated, right?
Right.
And church. I use a lot of slides in my presentations with images from popular culture, because I want to make whiteness really clear and visible for the average white person, right? Because the average white person thinks it's whether or not I said a racist joke or comment, and if I didn't say a racist joke or comment, then, you know, there's nothing happening. Mm-hmm. And I want them to see, like, how deeply embedded white supremacy is in the water of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say white supremacy, of course, I mean white as superior and central, not, you know, Aryan Nation, KKK.
Right.
And so, you know, living in segregation is still happening for most religious people, right? The Tuohy family certainly lived in a upper-class white neighborhood in segregation, went to a private school, all of those things. So,
mm-hmm.
so that would be the first place religious people should look. But then even when they come down to save, then you've got that white savior, a kind of mentality that's deeply problematic, right?
Mm-hmm.
That white benefactor and white benevolence and innocence and even that kind of specialness, the good white and the bad white. And it's always a key theme in those kinds of movies,
mm-hmm.
right? There's the, you know, there's the racist whites, like her friends at the country club,
right?
You know, and there's that climactic scene we always love when the good white tells off those nasty bad whites, right?
Right.
Which is, of course, just reinforces again that this is about good or bad people. And the average white person like me, I don't relate to the mean, you know, I don't know if I can say the word bitchy on the radio.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, this is Los Angeles. You can.
I relate to the, you know, to the good one, right? And that's just such a problematic narrative to reinforce. So, I mean, there's the kind of, well, economic justice, really, that if we're talking Christians, that Jesus was talking about,
mm-hmm.
right? And, you know, it's hard for a rich man to what go to heaven as a camel to pass through an eye of a needle. There's so much on economic justice that, of course, is closely tied to race.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, don't misunderstand me, because I'm not saying, you know, end economic injustice and you'll end racism. I think they're two things that go together.
Right.
But they're not, you know, so the real issue is class. Let's just talk about class. Because as Barbara Smith, she's a scholar, and she says, you give me any situation, you put some color on it, it'll be worse.
Right.
Right? So you're poor? Okay, now be black and poor and see how that goes for you.
Right.
So I don't mean to digress, but I guess those are the things, is that no one is outside of race and racism that lives in this world, and certainly not in this country, and that, yes, perhaps on a spiritual level we're all one, but we don't live on the spiritual level. We live in the physical, and in the physical everyone is getting the same messages. So I would ask Christians or religious people to look at, one, how are you actually living your life, and who are you building relationships with?
Got it.
So to challenge segregation, and also this is a question I would love religious white folks to ask. Why is it okay for somebody's children to have an inferior education but not mine?
Interesting.
Huh?
We will put that out. You know, we're going to put that out to our audience, and we'll follow that. But that is an excellent, that's an excellent point.
Right. Like, why do we tolerate these structures? I mean, that guarantee inequitable outcomes, in this case, educationally. And we know that we would never, you know, allow our children, you know, to attend those schools, right? But it's
right.
Okay if somebody else does. Why don't we, instead of fighting to keep our schools separate, we fight to equalize schools?
Yeah.
Right? To me, that would be a very worthy religious goal.
That would be, and the interesting, I think, commentary behind that is that I think the common retort is, well, those people, they don't care about their kids. They're not no. active with their children. They're not married. They're having kids out of wedlock. All of those things start snowballing.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, of course, that's going to be an outcome of us living apart and relying on the most problematic representations, right? So
right.
that would lead us to say such a thing, right, that you don't value your children or you don't value education, right? I mean, that can only come from not having authentic relationships.
Exactly.
That you would say such a thing and think such a thing, right?
Exactly.
So for religious people who are going to interact, right, so the ones who aren't need to really look deeply at segregation, but for those who are, to really watch for that patronizing, benevolent, white savior kind of dynamic, and to be willing to be humbled and to learn and to have your worldview challenged rather than come down to proclaim, you know. And I also, on the blind side, it's like, okay, this one is worthy of saving because this one can make a lot of money in sports. I mean, why is no other child worthy of saving?
Mm-hmm.
But this one who was really great for their sports team.
Yeah, that's how the discovery was made, yes. And
yeah.
Why wasn't there some kind of activity beforehand? And, of course, this isn't an indictment on the Tui family.
Yeah. Oh, no.
But it's sort of here, since we are a Los Angeles-based show, we know how Hollywood kind of takes things and spins things, and they have their own institutionalized issues to how they tell the story. But moving along, and our time is almost up. This has just been so great. I want to ask you, just in closing, you know, we've got listeners that, you know, I might have a listener today, someone white, thinking, oh my gosh, this could be me. And then I have a Black or Latino listener like, this is so cool. How can people connect with you if they want to have a seminar or workshop at their company or even with their social group? How do they contact you?
Well, I have a website, so it's robindeangelo.com, and D'Angelo is spelled with an I, D-I. And you can just email to me through my website, and I'll get the email. And that is what I do and love to do, is to go and do seminars and workshops and work with different groups. So I think I'm pretty easy to find.
Yes, you are. And we'll make sure to on the show's social media imprint, we will definitely share that with our audience. And I just want to, again, thank you for talking with me today. You are fabulous, and we're going to have to bring you back.
Oh, thank you so much. Oh, I would be thrilled. It was just a real joy and pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much, Janet.
You are very welcome. And to our listeners, you can also get Dr. D'Angelo's books, both of her books. You go to her website and check it out. And I trust me, these two books will be the best thing in your library. And of course, I want to just give a shout out to my friend Lisa, who bought me my books, because she said I'm hard to shop for, but she nailed it. This was a birthday gift for me this year. Aww. And I knocked it out in two books out in 24 hours.
What a affirmation. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. And to our audience, we'll be back at same time, same place next week. Have a wonderful afternoon and have a wonderful week. And check us out online and keep getting social with me. Thank you so much.